Good morning once again, and thanks for coming back to our first thematic session of our 11th meeting of PBO and IFIs. First of all, let me explain your disappointment for seeing me here instead of Mrs. Teresa Leal Coelho. She is the chairwoman of the Budget and Finance Committee in this Parliament, but unfortunately she cannot attend this session today, and so I'll do my best to try to replace her in the chair role. Well, this session is a special one. And it is special because it is open to MPs and the press. And it is open to the MPs and the press. Why? Because we will be talking about taxation. And the control of tax, of government's tax power, is probably the oldest and more permanent competence of parliaments all over the world. And yet, in many countries, tax decisions made by governments and parliaments do not have enough economic technical background. In our community of PBOs and IFIs, there is a heterogeneity of experiences regarding this task. And so I think it will be very helpful to learn best practices from institutions who already have that experience, and that experience that comes under their remit. Sound economic judgment behind political decisions about taxation is not a piece of cake business. I mean, it takes a lot of intellectual training. It takes experience and diligence to work with databases. It is necessary to understand the tax system and how it works with the economy at large. It requires the knowledge of specific markets, because it is impossible to figure out budgetary impacts if, first of all, we do not design and figure out what the economic impacts of any tax initiative is. Two things come together. Portugal is one of the cases where this kind of technical assistance is not available, and probably it should be. But of course, there some change in the way tax decisions are made even at the Parliament would have to change in order to benefit from that expertise. And this is one of the main reasons why this session is open to MPs and the press at large. Okay. So, it is my pleasure to introduce you to our three speakers. They come from institutions who have good practices to share with respect to economic and budgetary impact of tax policy initiatives. So we have with us today Jenny Wilkinson, who heads the Australian PBO. We have also Sander van Velduzen. Have I spelled it well? Okay, who manages the public finance department at the Dutch CPB, the former Central Planning Bureau, now called Netherlands Bureau of policy and economic policy analysis. And we also have Luiz de Mello, who currently directs the policy studies at OECD's economics department. The CPB is one of the oldest and most prestigious IFIs we have in the world, in our community. It was created in 1946. The Australian PBO is quite recent. It has the same age as the Portuguese CFP. Both were born in 2012. But since the very beginning, your PBO has on its mandate the obligation of performing these exercises. And, of course, the economics department of the OECD is largely known for its expertise on economic analysis on virtually any subject, and taxation, of course, is not exempt from your competent eye. And, therefore, if you allow me, it is my pleasure now to give the floor to Jenny for the next 20 minutes.
Thanks very much. Can I add my thanks to the Portuguese Parliament, to the Public Finance Council, and to the Portuguese version of the Parliamentary Budget Office for hosting us today? And it is certainly a remarkable chamber to speak in. It's always a pleasure to speak to this network. This is my second opportunity to meet with members of the network, and when we get together, I guess what strikes me is that we have remarkably different mandates, we have remarkably different structures, we have remarkably different roles, but what we have is a common interest in the particular context of our own parliaments in improving public policy outcomes, and particularly fiscal and budgetary policy outcomes. And this network is a rich source of ideas about how we each grapple with what are often some common challenges, but sometimes quite different challenges in running our organisations. So I thought I'd start today by providing people with a very brief overview of the Australian Parliamentary Budget Office, because I think that context matters in thinking about any of the ways in which we're grappling with these policy problems. So the Australian Parliamentary Budget Office, as mentioned, was established in 2012. It's got a legislated mandate, and it's got a set of very clearly delineated roles. We evolved from an agreement within the Parliament between the government of the day and a number of minor parties and independent members of Parliament. And the very clear focus in establishing the Parliamentary Budget Office in Australia was on levelling the playing field between government and opposition parties to really improve the quality of the public policy debate. So our purpose has always been defined as informing and improving the public policy debate by providing independent, non-partisan analysis of fiscal and budgetary issues. We serve both parliamentarians and the public more generally. We, in the PBO in Australia, we provide confidential costing advice and other budget analysis directly to parliamentarians upon requests from them. We provide advice to parliamentary committees when they request it of us. That advice is generally made public by the committees. And then we also have a mandate to conduct and publish our own independent research and analysis. We're a completely independent organisation. We don't work for the government of the day. We can't be directed as to how we go about our analysis, and we can't be directed as to the content of our research program. So that's a matter for us to determine. In terms of the scope of our functions, there's three main elements to the Australian PBO's work program. We spend a lot of our resources providing costing advice that estimate the the fiscal impact of policy proposals to change Australian government either expenditure or taxation arrangements. We provide that advice over the short and the medium term. This advice covers the gamut of policies that parliaments are responsible for. So it includes expenditure on any federal program, social welfare programs, health, education, aged care, infrastructure programs, just to name but a few. It also includes providing advice on any element of federal taxation arrangements. Now, our advice focuses on the fiscal impact of policy proposals, and it includes, but it can include advice about what the distributional impact of those policies could be. We don't provide advice about whether policies are a good idea or a bad idea. We don't express an opinion as to what a parliamentarian should do. We're trying to provide information that can be used by parliamentarians to then enable them to make better decisions themselves. So, as I said, a lot of our resources are contained in providing advice on costings. The second thing we do is that we work to improve transparency around fiscal policy settings. And that's by publishing accessible documents that try and explain the budget to people and provide insights into the drivers of the budget outcomes over both the short and the medium term. Some of these papers focus in depth on particular issues which are pertinent at the time. The third thing that we do, and this is a piece of work that we have to conduct around every election, is that we increase transparency around the fiscal implications of election commitments by analysing and publishing assessments of the aggregate impact of each party's election platform. That comes around much more rapidly often than we would hope, but it's, you know, roughly every 3 years we have an election, and that's a very major piece of work for us. I think it's important to emphasise that unlike many of the other institutions represented here today, the PBO does not have any responsibility for macroeconomic forecasting or for assessing the validity of the government's macro forecasts. In fact, where our legislation explicitly forbids us from having a different view about the macro outlook than the government has. But it doesn't stop us from providing analysis around what the impact of different macro scenarios could have on the fiscal situation. So we certainly can provide scenario analysis, but we can't put forward a different set of macro forecasts. Now, today's session is focusing on tax policies. So what do we do particularly with respect to tax policies? Our analysis kind of falls into three main categories, as I've sort of mentioned. We analyse proposals for new tax measures. These usually are in response to requests from individual parliamentarians. And what's been interesting since the establishment of the PBO in 2012 is that the fact that we can provide this advice to parliamentarians seems to have enabled opposition parties to much more confidently explore tax reform proposals than they have been able to do in the past. In recent years, opposition parties have proposed some really significant tax reform in Australia, and in almost all of these cases, PBO analysis has provided information on both the budget and the distributional impacts of those policies, which I believe has contributed to internal party deliberations about the suite of policy reforms that parties would like to pursue, well ahead of those policies actually being announced. The second set of suites or sort of advice that we provide around tax policy is when a tax policy is presented, a piece of legislation on tax is presented to Parliament, we are tending to get a request from parliamentary committees to provide supplementary information to information that has already been provided by government on those tax policies. That sometimes involves analysing different elements of the tax policy, providing more transparency around what the impacts would be. But it also includes analysis of amendments that parliamentarians are considering putting forward during the parliamentary debate on that piece of legislation. So we're very much actively involved when a piece of legislation is being debated in the parliament. The third broad area of analysis, as I mentioned, is our research program. We've always had a significant focus on taxation measures. Recent reports that we've released have focused on things like the sustainability of different tax bases and on distributional issues such as changes in the impact of change or what changes in average tax rates across different quintiles in the Australian population are. So in Australia, tax policy and advice within government is the responsibility of the Treasury, and no other agencies really have the capability to scrutinise tax policy at a detailed level or to understand the models that are used to examine tax policies. This is quite unlike expenditure policies, where individual line agencies often that have responsibility for implementing expenditure policies, such as our social welfare policies, there's oversight of those agencies by the Department of Finance and by the Treasury. And so it means that there's much more active discussion or debate within the bureaucracy around expenditure programs than there is around tax policies. The capability that we've developed in the PBO to analyse tax policy has enabled a richer engagement between ourselves and the Treasury on tax matters. We scrutinise Treasury models, we develop our own models, we share them back with the Treasury. So it's broadened the debate within the bureaucracy around tax policy more generally. When we provide advice on tax policy, more than anything else, we try to provide advice that's transparent, that's clear, that's accessible, and that is widely perceived to be objective. We always analyse budget impacts over the medium term, which is the budget year plus 10 years. We always outline in our advice what the key assumptions are that we've made. We explain the methodologies that we've applied in deriving our estimates. We put quite a lot of effort into describing what are the elements of behavioural responses that we have incorporated in our estimates. We explain the uncertainties associated with these estimates, and we provide distributional analysis if that's requested by the parliamentarian. We have carefully considered, and we've released discussion papers explaining what our approach is to considering broader economic impacts in our costings of tax policies. And in these papers we've explained what we perceive to be the challenges of doing so. I guess a very strong sense that I have is that if you're going to include broader economic impact in analysis of tax policies, you have to be prepared to include broader economic impact in your analysis of expenditure policies. There's no particular difference between tax and expenditure policies, which means that economic impacts need to be included in one and not the other. The view that we have come to in the PBO is that the first round impact on public revenues changes in tax policy is really critical for parliamentarians to understand. These first round impacts do include the behavioural responses of individuals who are directly affected by the policies themselves. Our view is that the broader economic impacts on other markets and on the macroeconomy more generally are certainly much more challenging to estimate and, in our experience, are likely to be much more contested. This doesn't mean that these impacts are not important drivers of reform. Ensuring that your tax system is efficient is important in supporting longer-term growth. But I think our view is that the benefits of tax reforms can take quite a long time to manifest themselves, particularly in budget outcomes. And the impact on the budget outcome shouldn't be the driver of those reforms. So theory as much as budget estimates is what should be used when providing policy guidance on reform. We may come back to a broader discussion of this in the later discussion. So I think that PBOs need to be mindful of the risks that they may face if they take strong philosophical positions on the macroeconomic impacts of any particular policies that are being considered. Now, it was mentioned that it would be interesting to get a sense of sort of what sort of resourcing is required for this sort of a policy. Adequate resourcing is really important if you're going to do this sort of analysis properly. You have to have access to tax data, administrative tax data, so that means like individual level tax data, as well as aggregate data. You have to have access to tax models, which are used within government, as well as the capacity to build your own models. And we have both a suite of micro-simulation models as well as more aggregate models that we use in our tax policy work. You have to have the capability within the PBO to actually run these models. You can't just be a passive user of them. You have to have an excellent understanding of the tax policy framework that you're working in to understand what the interactions between different tax policies may be. And you have to have a good understanding of what the evidence is about at least what the first round behavioural responses to particular policies should be. In the Australian PBO, we have, to get into sort of concrete terms, we have 10 staff who we use for analysing tax policy proposals. We have 2 staff who spend most of their time doing tax policy research. We have a very clear memorandum of understanding between the PBO and government departments, which is what provides us with access to data and models that's critical to doing our work. And we've had to upgrade our computer systems in order to make sure that we've got the sort of IT systems that are capable of dealing with the very large data sets that we manage on a daily basis. I'll just give you a quick sense of a particular piece of advice that we provided, which was we provided publicly, which is why I can speak about it. And this complements a number of different pieces of advice that we've provided over recent years. Recent years, we've analysed tax reforms, which have included changes in personal income tax rates and scales, changes in corporate tax rates, changes in investment incentives, changes to the way capital gains are taxed, changes to the tax treatment of different investment vehicles such as trusts. So we've really provided analysis of over, you know, most areas of taxation policy. This particular piece of work that we did around the personal income tax plan was in response to a piece of legislation that was brought before Parliament last year. So last year the government announced a proposal to cut personal income taxes. There were 3 different stages of this particular reform that were captured in the one piece of legislation. So stage 1 commenced on the 1st of July in 2018, stage 2 was to commence or is to commence on the 1st of July 2022, and stage 3 from the 1st of July 2024. The budget papers where this policy was announced did provide some detail on what the fiscal impact of these 3 stages of the personal income tax plan would be over the forward estimates, which in Australia is just the budget plus the next 3 years, and they provided an aggregate impact over the medium term. So the budget papers produced by the government provided this sort of information. They gave you a sense that the cost of stage 1 of the plan was going to be a bit under $20 billion over 10 years. The cost of stage 2 was about $90 billion and the cost of stage 3 was about $40 billion. These government figures made it look like the bulk of the cost of the tax package was in stage 2 of the tax package. And much less so in stage 3. But As we all know, the devil's always in the detail for these sorts of, for when data is provided, and in this particular case, aggregating figures over time when the different stages started at different periods of time meant that there was less transparency in these figures than some of the parliamentarians were after. So we received requests from opposition members and crossbench parties for supplementary information. They asked us for year-by-year impacts of the budget impact of each component of the tax package, a year-by-year budget impact of the medium term of each stage, and then they were also interested in what the distributional impacts of the package were by income and by gender. And we needed to be in a position to turn this sort of analysis around within a couple of weeks because the legislation was being debated at that stage. So this is the first, this gives you an idea, you know, we provided some information about what the impact of the tax package would be, not in aggregate, but in individual years as the tax package flowed out. And you can see that this provides a different picture of what the impact of the tax package would be than when you looked at it at an aggregate level. We provided analysis of what the impact of the tax package would be by gender. So provide an indication of the number of males and the number of females who would be benefiting from each stage of the tax package. Now, these outcomes simply reflected the underlying distribution of income and the sort of gender wage gap at different income levels. They didn't really reflect a particular element of the tax package, but nonetheless there were parliamentarians who were interested in getting a sense of who were the people who were going to benefit from a gender perspective from different elements of the tax package. The other thing that we analysed was the impact of the tax package on the change in average tax rates across income quintiles. So this shows you the bottom 20% of the population, the second, the next, you know, 20 to 40, all the way up to the top 20% of the population from the first to the fifth quintiles. And just to understand what's going on here, so this shows the change in average tax rates in Australia by quintile. Between 2017-18, so the year this was announced, and 2026-27, so roughly over the next decade. And in Australia, unlike some other countries, our personal income tax thresholds are set in nominal levels, so they're not indexed with inflation, wages or income. So as nominal incomes rise, an individual's average tax rate will naturally rise over time. So this is just bracket creep. And so what we showed in this analysis was, first of all, we estimated what we thought was the likely evolution of average tax rates by income quintile. Those are the green columns. So, for example, our analysis showed that the average tax rates were going to rise the most for the second and third income quintiles over this 10-year period. And then we analysed what the impact of the tax package would be. And so the blue bars show you what the increase in average tax rates would be after the tax package was introduced. So this is just another way of showing it. The orange bars show you what the impact of the tax package was, so that it reduced average tax rates the most for the top income quintile, broadly similarly for the middle three income quintiles, and had relatively little impact for the lowest income quintile. So I'm really just providing this as an indication of the sort of analysis that we provided in response to a piece of legislation that was introduced to Parliament. So overall, the PBO contribution to many legislative debates, but particularly tax debates, has been highly valued. It's certainly perceived to have levelled the playing field between parliamentarians and enabled better engagement in fiscal policy debates. While our analysis hasn't extended to economic impacts, it does provide improvements in transparency, partly because we've been able to address questions that are questions that parliamentarians themselves are grappling with when they're considering debate, participating in the debate over particular pieces of tax policy. As I said, the main thing that we try and do is make sure that our advice is drafted in a way that's accessible to a wide audience. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jenny. I think the case study you presented us clearly shows the usefulness of sound economic analysis to make better policy decisions. And I now call Sander van Veldhuizen to bring to us the experience of CPB. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. Thanks to the organization for this this nice event. It's very nice to speak here. So this is the first time that I'm ever at an OECD meeting, and this is the first time that I'm going to speak at an OECD meeting. So I'm the successor of Wim Suiker, for those who don't know that. So Wim has given up public finance since 2017, and I'm his successor since then. And since, well, that was the period after our charter choices, so the analysis of the election manifestos and the assessment of a coalition agreement, so it was a natural point in time for Wim to slow down a bit. And since then I've taken over, and I will tell you a bit about how we do things in the Netherlands. I will not talk about the CPB, who we are, and how things are arranged in the Netherlands, because I assume that you probably have heard that many times before, since we are the oldest IFI in the world, since 1946. And we have been assessing election manifestos since 1986. So at that time, I was a little child. So that's how long. So I was really born and raised in this setting that we have in the Netherlands. So I'm happy to talk about it, but for me, it's always a bit weird to talk about things that are, well, a common sense for me. So I'll talk you a bit about macroeconomic forecasting. I'll talk you a bit about CPP's toolkit, and I have two case studies if there's time. Because we think in the Netherlands to have sound political decisions on tax policy, it's important to see all the effects, and not only the budgetary effects, but also the macroeconomic effects. And for that reason, I will tell you a bit about how the forecasting cycle at the CPB looks, what it looks like, and how it's intertwined with the budgetary decision-making process, and also with the elections, because it's all intertwined in the Netherlands. So first, we start with the medium-term cycle. So this cycle is what I've shown here. So it basically has five steps. So before the elections, we start with the medium-term outlook. That is the baseline for the analysis of the election manifestos. Then we get general elections. We have this famous charter choices exercise that we do. And at some point in time, sometimes it takes a bit longer than other years. So last year, in 2017, it took almost 9 months. We get a coalition, and they work out a coalition agreement, which we also assess. And in that assessment of the coalition agreement, there is usually there are usually tax measures. There's basically a tax plan for the next 4 years, which we analyze ex ante. So we have an ex ante test that basically means that you do a budgetary test, so you see what the ex ante budgetary consequences are, somewhat reasonable. And a second thing that we always test is a legal test, so whether it's legally feasible. And we also test whether you can execute it. So in let's say recent years, so the tax office in the Netherlands has some implementation problems, so it's not always feasible to do something very exotic. And that's something that we also look at. And if it's too exotic, then we're going to say, you know, you're not able to implement this in the next 4 years, and therefore you cannot, we're not going to take this specific tax measure into account. So at that point in time when we publish it, then everybody knows in the Netherlands what actually the tax policy and actually all policy for the next 4 years is going to look like. This is really the key moment where you fix the tax plan for that 4 years, and we make an analysis of that. So that's the key moment in the Dutch cycle, well, in the regular 4 year cycle. That's what I want to show. Yeah, and after the coalition agreement, we update the medium-term outlook, and that is fed into the official budgetary numbers. And then you get the whole cycle again. We also have a short cycle. That's the, let's say, the annual budgetary cycle. So per year we make 4 forecasts, of which one is not really important, so that's the one that is shaded a bit, so that's in December. So we make 4 forecasts because it looks nicer than 3, so 3 are only important for the budget, and the one in December is because we have to do something in December. Now basically what is important is what starts in March. So in March there's decision making on the expenditures. So not really interesting for tax policy and its macroeconomic consequences, but it's the start of the cycle. And in March, the implementation of the tax plan also starts. So the Ministry of Finance starts making forecasts of individual tax measures, and they give them to us. And the idea is that we have to certify them. And we certify them in... the certification is published in September. And in the September forecast, also the tax plan is published with the certification of us. And the certification basically means that what the Ministry of Finance has done in the, let's say, ex ante assessment of the individual tax measures is whether that was reasonable, whether the forecasts were unbiased. And we feed that into our macroeconomic model. So that's what I think the interesting things comes into play. So how does that really work in practice? And for that, I have made a figure. So that's the next slide. So that's the toolkit. I can talk about how this all works, like institutionally, but that is not really interesting for this moment, I guess, because I think what Jenny already told you, that's basically how things also work in the Netherlands. It's quite alike. So we have models. You need models to assess the macroeconomic consequences of these tax measures. And here at the CPB, we have a suite of models. And these are basic, so this is a stylized overview of the models that we have. So they are arranged by theme. So we have models for healthcare, for income and prices, for construction sector, energy, labor market. We also have dedicated models to forecast tax revenues. And we also have dedicated models for government spending. So those are the ones highlighted at the, center and right top. So how it works in practice, so the macroeconomic model, so that's really the center of the models that we have. So all the models communicate through the macroeconomic model. And the macroeconomic model is basically two things. At the one hand, it's a traditional structural model that has behavioral equations, which describes the Dutch economy. And on the other hand, it's just an administration. So it's basically a centralized administration of all policy impulses that you have. And all these models talk to each other. They talk to each other through the macroeconomic model. So that keeps the process somehow, so that you can stay in control about how these models communicate with each other. So that's why all the arrows are going to the center. Usually, when it's not a too complex measure, it takes 3 or 4 iterations to get to a stable solution, a stable forecast. The satellite models, that's also what Jenny already told you, they have to be fed by data. And those data, they usually come from the tax authorities or from the Ministry of Finance or other confidential sources. So it's not only key to have very good models and to develop those models in-house, it's also very important for us to have access to confidential data. I think that's one of the most important things nowadays, that the better data you have, the better forecast you can make, because there is lots of data available in the outside world. And I think that we do not have a formal memorandum of understanding with the Ministry of Finance and tax authorities to share those data with us. We just get them, as far as I understood, because I've never signed a memorandum of understanding. So that's not formally arranged in the Netherlands. It's on the basis of good faith, I guess. So maybe 2 models to dig a bit deeper into. So first we have the mixer model. So that's a model that's evidence-based, an integrated microsimulation model for tax reforms. So this has been in development at the CPB for, I think, 2 decades. And it has 2 crucial elements. So one is evidence-based. So if you have discussions about the outcomes of the model, then we always say it's evidence-based. All the outcomes are based on are computed with a large and rich data set on the labor force. So we have very detailed information about the Dutch working force, actually about the whole Dutch population. So I know, in principle, I know from every Dutch citizen all his characteristics that are available, at least in data. So that's what we feed the models with. So in principle, it's evidence-based and it's integrated. And integrated means that it generates all relevant output that you want. With one push at the button, that's the idea, and then it takes 2 days to calculate it. That's the only drawback right now. And it can spit out everything that you want. So you have budgetary effects, ex ante and exposed. We can compute effects on disposable income. We can compute effects on income inequality and also on labor supply. So this one is mostly used for labor supply effects. So this is the only model that can calculate structural labor supply effects. Another model, this is the core model at the CPB, that's called SAFIR, and that's the acronym for short and medium term analysis and forecasting using formal implementation of economic reasoning. So this is the thing, if people are talking about the CPB model, this is the CPB model. These are the economic relations that we model, so this is basically some, I don't know, 30 behavioral equations, and then there's an administration behind that, that's roughly 3,000 equations. And the way we feed tax policies, new tech policies into the model is at the top right circle. That's called government policy. So there we can feed the model with new tax policies. And you can also feed the model with other things, but this is for this session the only relevant thing. And we can talk about this model for days, I guess, if I'm going to explain how this really works. Not really interesting right now. You need models, but what is more important, I guess, is that you need very good economists. And talking about implementing new tax policies or new tax measures. So these are roughly the people that do that at CPB. So these are the experts. So we're talking about roughly 15 experts that only look at individual tax measures and know everything about, let's say, the whole policy behind it. So those are well-trained economists, mostly males. So when I started working at CPB in 2009, there was only one female in this group. Now we have four, I believe. Yeah. Let's say male-female balance is going into the right direction. Also good to see that we have younger people. So CPB used to be an institution with quite old people, with quite elder people. And now we see there's a new generation coming up that is going to do this for the next decade. So it's really important. That's what we noticed, is that first you have to have very good experts, very good economists, people that understand and can talk with policymakers, understand economics. So that was very well arranged at CPB. And then there comes a point in time that the experts are going to retire. And then you create a new problem. Then you create a very big problem for the near future. And that's for us, still a challenge. How do you keep those highly talented young economists? And that's difficult to solve. Maybe some case studies. So the first case study is the one that I worked on last year, that is on the dividend withholding tax. So maybe you've heard about it, that the coalition in the Netherlands decided at the end of 2017, they decided that they want to abolish the dividend withholding tax. It was written down in the coalition agreement, which we analyzed, and at that time there was a budgetary impact of, a lost revenue of 1.4 billion euros, structural. In 2020 onwards, from 2020 onwards. Already at the time of the coalition agreement, there was lots of political debate about it, because it was, at least the opposition thought this was a tax measure that was in the advantage of multinationals. So there was lots of economic debate on, lots of political debate on that, also some economists involved in there, but we were somewhere in the middle, we were quite silent at the moment, and the discussion went onwards. And the thing was that there was a measure where you structurally lose 1.4 billion and you get no macroeconomic impulse for it back. Because we analyze it as follows. So this is a pure revenue that goes to the that flows abroad. And the idea is that the Netherlands will become a more attractive country for multinationals. But the empirical evidence on that is very narrow. There's no very really hard empirical evidence that this mechanism works in that way. So that's why we said, well, we're not going to give you a macroeconomic effect for that. So politically, the debate is about you transfer 1.4 billion to other countries, you get nothing back for it. It's the same as throwing each year 1.4 billion euros into the sea. So that was at that time. So we took it up in a medium-term outlook. And then political tensions started to rise because this new government also had made a new budgetary rule that at the time there is new information available, you have to incorporate in your forecast for that specific tax rule. So when we recasted it after early March, we already knew that. The structural loss of revenues added up to 1.9 billion euros. So that in the end also came into the media. So it was during the summer. Well, political tensions become higher because now it's not 1.4, it's 1.9, almost 2 billion. And we already knew that this 1.9 was really an underestimation. So then the process goes on. We get the tax plan. That also meant that I had to certify this tax measure. So then you get the discussion. So the Ministry of Finance also makes a forecast, and then came up with 1.9 structural loss, and I had to certify it. And we certified it as that the forecast was reasonable. It was unbiased, but there was high uncertainty around it whether it was really going to be 1.9 or probably more. The process continues, so we fed this in our, regular forecast in September. So on budget day, this measure was still there with non-economic effects, but a structural loss of 1.9 billion at that point in time. And then on the Friday morning of October 5, Unilever decided that their headquarters was not going to move to the Netherlands, but stays in London. And that was a point. So at that time, there was political decision making that the abolition of the dividend withholding tax was abolished. And there was a new, in a week or 2 weeks' time, there was a new tax plan drafted for how they can spend the 1.9 billion euros, which we had to certify again. And also feed it back into our macroeconomic models. So this is a very labor-intensive, procedure for us, but luckily we have, roughly 20 experts working on that, so for us it's manageable. But this also means if you're going to do macroeconomic forecast, if you want to calculate the macroeconomic effects of tax, individual tax measures, you could be facing this kind of, process. Not always very nice. And in the end, the 1.9 billion was given back to domestic companies in the form of tax reliefs. So this is another example. This is a bit more easier. In the coalition agreement, there was the idea of raising tax credits for specific groups of people. There's this whole cycle again analysis of election manifestos, coalition agreements. So at this time, in this particular case, we already analyzed this specific measure in the chartered choices exercise, so in the analysis of the election manifestos. And luckily for us in the coalition agreement, there were two parties that had precisely this measure, and they were also part of the coalition. So that process was much cleaner, in a sense. So we can take it up in the medium-term outlook. And we analyze this with this mixing model, and then you see that for a tax credit, you get these are the results. So there was a general tax credit, had a budgetary impact of 1.5 billion euros. Structural employment goes slightly up, not too much. And we also calculated, we also write things about the effects on productivity, about inequality. So this particular measure increases the income inequality a bit. And if you have a targeted specific tax credit raise, then you see that you can decrease the income inequality. That's what you see in the bottom box. It also has a budgetary impact of 1.5 billion euros. So these were my examples, and I think... Yeah, that was it. So I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for the food you gave for our thought to more interesting case studies. Now I'd like Luis to have the floor for you for the next 20 minutes.
Muito obrigado, Rui. Good morning. Thanks for the invitation. I'd like to extend my appreciation to Tal, to CFP, Rui, Teodora Cardoso for the invitation to be here. Great pleasure to join the network again. Thanks, Robert, for your leadership as chair of this network. It's always an interesting moment in the year in the calendar of the OECD, as Marcos mentioned, not to be able to talk about public finance issues. And in this particular case, to share with you some of the work that we've been doing in the public finance area in the economics department. I was telling Rui that I was also impressed that we are in a room with two former finance ministers, Maria Luisa Albuquerque and Jorge Braga de Macedo, my great friend. So it's added responsibility and opportunity for us to be able to talk about these issues in their presence. The work we've been doing at the OECD on public finances, in particular in the economics department, has been motivated by a number of things. So I'd like to spend a few moments with this general context. What we are seeing is that the most countries in the OECD area already have pretty high tax stakes, spending to GDP levels and debt levels. So that makes society very conscious of the trade-offs that policymakers face when they needed to address public finance issues by either cutting spending or raising revenue to address the sustainability issues in the public finances. We also see, just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, this is basically the average tax stake and composition in the OECD area. You see that there has been a gradual increase. We are talking, these are numbers corrected for the cycle, so it's a pretty structural tax to GDP ratios. We see an increase. I don't even have to go back to the post-war period, the initial phase of the post-war period, to see this very rapid increase in the tax stake. But if you look even at the last 20 years, there is already an increase in that number to something in the neighborhood of 42% of GDP in the OECD area. Composition hasn't changed much. But you see that basically taxes such as social security contributions and consumption taxes have been growing over time as well. And other ones that could be addressing issues such as the ones that Paul mentioned before, such as environmental taxes, they remain pretty constant in proportion of GDP. So societies are becoming very intolerant of increases in tax, which adds an extra responsibility for policymakers and governments, which is to find, to understand basically all the impacts that additional tax measures can have. If you look at the perception of efficiency in government, you see that the vast majority of OECD countries are in a situation where increases in the tax stake are associated with an increase in the perception by society of a loss of efficiency, if you want, with a few exception of the Nordic countries there that tend to combine very high numbers of perception of efficiency and at the same time comparatively high tax to GDP ratios. But overall, governments are under pressure indeed throughout the OECD area to be efficient and to be more cost effective in tax policy and expenditure policy more broadly. Let me turn to another couple of points on context. We also see in our dialogue with countries, and that I think it's fair to say, Jenny, that you pointed in the same direction, Sander, you too, that conventional analysis of tax policy tends to focus on budgetary aspects. So it's basically impact on the tax take, on revenue, and on the expenditure side, impact on the broad budgetary aggregates, but much less so on other impacts such as on allocative efficiency and ultimately on GDP growth, and even much less on incidence. most notably the distribution of income or distribution of wealth, which is even harder to do than the distribution of income. So we've been seeing this, that there is, in some parts of the world, a growing emphasis on the need to broaden the range of impacts that tax policy may have. And another interesting point that at least we've been observing, again, in our dialogue with countries, is that tax policy is being seen more and more as part of a broader or as an element in broader public finance reform. So it's not tax policy in isolation, but also in combination with expenditure items, the refine or reform of entitlement programs and so on, so that these trade-offs about raising tax in a context of already high expenditure to GDP ratios can be looked at. Let me turn then to a few numbers about how we're going about looking at these things. What have we been doing by and large? And of course, there is a lot of work that is done at the aggregate level, a lot of the work that is being done in terms of micro simulations of specific tax measures in different parts of the world. Some emphasis also on sectoral impacts of tax policy. But what I'll show here now is what we've been done at the pretty aggregate cross-country level. So we are looking basically at impacts of tax policy by looking at those two broad elements, impacts on growth, allocative efficiency, and impact on the household, on the distribution of household disposable income, to have a sense of those effects on the distribution of income as well. The bulk of the analysis is done through aggregate cross-country econometric models, looking at production functions in combination with information on the distribution of income by decile. So it's not a work that we see very often of impacts on growth and income distribution using synthetic measures of income distribution. What we're trying to do is to be a bit more granular and to see what's happening throughout the income distribution by looking at information that is available for most OECD countries based on household income and expenditure surveys, that basically allows you to have a more careful look at impacts at the decile level. Jenny, you just mentioned impacts at the quartile level, but it's in the same spirit of basically looking at the distribution rather than synthetic measures of distribution of income. We are looking at as many OECD countries as we can. So the numbers I'm going to show you here are numbers for 35 countries over a period that spans about three decades of public finance aggregates. So if you look at what I just mentioned, impacts on growth and income distribution, by and large, what we see that comes out of cross-country analysis is the following. The way to read this chart basically is to say, well, you have a number of tax measures there. For instance, the first row of this table, raising recurrent property taxes. The standard deviation on average across OECD countries of changes, fluctuations in the revenue from recurrent property taxes is about 0.2% of GDP. So not a huge variation in that. It's not the level, it's the variation over time. But suppose you can think of a stylized reform which consists of changing or increasing those property taxes by the standard deviation of the OECD area, which is about 0.2% of GDP. What you get is an impact on growth that is, close to 3.5% over the longer term. Again, as Jenny, you mentioned, the spirit of objective here is not to look at the short-term impact of those measures, but look at the steady state over a number of years. What is the impact that you can expect of that reform action on growth? You see also the thin horizontal line there gives you an idea of the heterogeneity of responses across countries. So a few countries that have even stronger impacts, others that have weaker impacts than the one that I've just mentioned on average. What is the objective of it? I mean, obviously, in each individual country, the specificities of your tax code that you can deal with to conduct micro simulations, to conduct time series analysis. So you will have an even finer way of looking at how or looking at the impact of those tax measures. From our standpoint, what we wanted to do with this is to inform your own help, to help you inform the policy debate in your own countries, but at least looking at the cross-country perspective. It's not only what is going to, the effects that can be measured in your own context, but also what you could expect given the whole range of possibilities and features of tax codes in other advanced economies. No? So, this is what the horizontal lines are telling you. So you see impacts for raising recurrent property taxes, impacts for lowering wealth taxes, impacts for easing the tax burden on above average labor earnings. So I don't need to read the whole table, but it gives you an idea of that type of stylized effect. The colors that you have there is basically a way of identifying the reforms according to their impact on the income distribution, right? So the blue bars are the ones where we don't find a discernible, a statistically discernible impact on the income distribution. It doesn't mean that there aren't winners and losers. It's just the average impact is not statistically strong. That is the case of raising recurrent property taxes. We know that it's one of the least distorting taxes that governments have. So it's not a surprise that the impact on growth will be positive and the impact on the distribution of income will not be so strong. The bars that you have there that are marked in red are the ones where that can lead to a widening of the income distribution. And not a surprise that if you lower wealth taxes, even though the tax to GDP ratio of wealth taxes in the OECD area is tiny, but if you lower those even further, then there will be an impact of an increase, a widening in the income distribution. And then you have other taxes that have a positive impact on growth. Say, for instance, if you ease the labor tax wedge on low earnings, so basically if you make those on low incomes, if you reduce the tax wedge on those low incomes, you'll have a positive impact on growth via reallocation effects, via incentives for labor force participation and the usual channels that we know. But at the same time, it has a positive effect on narrowing the distribution of income by basically compressing the dispersion of wages as a result of that measure. So this, again, is a way of looking at a set of stylized reforms, looking at how they impact the revenue, which is the standard way of doing this, you know, what most governments do first and foremost, but this is already a way of looking at growth and income distribution as additional economic rather than budgetary impact of those measures. Let me illustrate here what I meant by income distribution effects. Take this case, for instance, that's the gist of the exercise that you do, that we do. You see, I mentioned before, I referred to the case of the wealth taxes, for instance. What happens if you lower wealth taxes? We find a positive impact on growth, and we find an effect on the income distribution that is to widen that income distribution. And that's what you saw, that's what you see here. No? If you take that stylized reform, according to the average, if you want, or the standard deviation of the OECD, you get a picture like that across the income distributions, so going from the lowest decile on the left to the highest decile on the right. And then you see that if you lower wealth taxes, you're going to benefit the rich more than you benefit the poor. On average, there is a gain throughout the income distribution, but those on top deciles will benefit more than those on bottom deciles. Let me show you an opposite case of a reform option that tends to narrow the income distribution. It's a case of inheritance taxes. What we find is a long-term effect associated with that that is positive on growth and at the same time tends to improve the distribution of income because it affects top deciles. So the better off more than it does, the worse off the lower deciles of the distribution. I mean, I can carry on showing you different examples of that, but I think that gives you an idea, an illustration of the type of analysis that can be done at the cross-country level, at the aggregate level, but can be used to underpin some of the reform options that you are that your governments are or may be entertaining. Let me move on to something that is also interesting from the point of view of looking at trade-offs, complementarities, unintended consequences of tax and spending initiatives. Take this case, for instance, that we look not only at what's happening on the tax side, but also what can be happening on the spending side. So suppose you have a policy that consists of combining cuts in subsidy with a reduction in the low-income tax wedge. We know that cuts or a reduction in low-income tax wedge tends to be good for growth and at the same time improve the income distribution. And we also know that that cutting subsidies, I don't have the time to explain here all the types of subsidies that we are looking at, but also tends to have a positive impact on growth and income distribution. And what we see across the OECD area is a situation where the blue bars show you what the impact would be on the lower deciles of the distribution, and the triangles, the orange and whatever that color is, I can't see to be honest, but show you what you would have at the top of the or the higher deciles of the income distribution. So again, this is not basically advocacy of what type of taxes and spending policies you should be looking at, but it's basically a tool that you can use to inform the policy debate that you may be considering as a way of addressing some public finance concern in your country. This type of analysis that looks at tax and spending as a package and at the same time looks at economic impacts as opposed to purely budgetary impacts is very useful from the political economy point of view. This is, I think, pretty evident. If you look at policies that could focus on reducing disposable income disparities, you can, on the basis of this analysis, already identify a few tax measures that would deliver on the basis of cross-country aggregate analysis that type of outcome. If you want to look for policies that improve income levels for across the distribution, so for all deciles, but don't necessarily alter the distribution of those effects, there is again a number of reform options that you can entertain, and so on. So you can think of combinations of policy objectives and tax instruments and stylized reform options that would deliver that type of consideration. This is obviously a tool that for us is carried out in the context of our committees, the dialogue with our countries, of essentially an analytical nature. The idea here is to provide a basis of evidence for policymakers, but also that allows us to point to directions where countries that are facing political economy challenges, and I think it would be fair to say that it's the case of most of us, that gives an added tool, if you want, for considering alternative policy interventions, communicating those alternative policy interventions to the population so that in the end the credibility of the reforms that are being proposed can be enhanced through the type of analytical exercise that is available to all of you. Our idea and our ambition is to always make available policy tools that different countries, different people, different institutions can then look at possible combinations, again on the basis of cross-country stylized reform packages, and then test what you could expect to find in the context of your own policy debate. Thank you very much.
Recovering the time because we are running behind the schedule. Nevertheless, I think these three inspiring addresses have probably echoes in our minds, and I'm sure there are comments, remarks, doubts, questions from our delegates. So I'm pleased to collect two or three of them. Yes?
Hi. Thank you very much for the interesting presentations. I had a question for Jenny. Jenny, you said that you cost, I think, the aggregate fiscal implications of all the major political parties. I just wondered how you define major. Would that be, I'm just thinking in terms of a minor party may hold the balance of power. Would you define major as anyone who's likely to be elected to the Parliament? And also, can you maybe unpack a bit how it works in practice in terms of the timing of when you produce your analyses? Is that quite an uncomfortable position for you? Maybe talk us through how it works in practice. Thanks.
If there are more interventions from those benches. Yes, George, please go forward.
I had a question on which this panel in particular could perhaps comment. Is the issue which in the U.S. in particular, but I guess in other countries as well, occasionally surfaces in a political debate, is the dynamic versus static scoring of tax measures. We have faced this in Hungary. In Hungary, Fiscal Council 1.0, this is the early version, and we went for dynamic scoring in the sense, which is actually what I think implicitly the CPB does ultimately, but we didn't have such a fancy modeling family of models to rely on. What we did, since we didn't have behavioral elasticities in some cases, with a specific issue which of course irritated the government at the time, where they came out with a flat tax proposal, and the government claimed that it would generate like 100,000 jobs in the marketplace over a 4-year period, which in Hungary is a lot, 100,000. And what we did was to look at elasticities, labor demand elasticities of more or less comparable countries, looking at the literature, and we took the most ambitious elasticity estimate. We worked with that, and we actually came out with a fraction of that number. I don't remember exactly now, 20,000 jobs or something. Maybe Laszlo Jankovic, who was my director of costing and budgetary policies, maybe he can remember. But in any case, that didn't really materialize. But we had this, we were forced practically to do the dynamic scoring to actually assess the validity of that claim by the government at the time. But I'm just curious about views on this.
Yes, please, Ms. Maria Luisalbkerk.
Thank you. Just a very quick question, either for the Netherlands or Australia. Do you do ex post assessments? Do you do the ex ante assessments? Once the policies are implemented, how do you do the assessment, and how do you compare to your previous evaluations of the impacts of tax decisions, namely, but others would also be useful. Thank you.
Okay, well, now I take the privilege of being your chair, and I'd like also to make a complimentary question to what George has said, which is, I'm curious to know how the CPB and the Australian PBO deal with the uncertainty of point estimates. You presented precise figures, but we all know that uncertainty surrounds any impact estimate. And, of course, it will be helpful for political debate if there were no uncertainty, and because that would anchor the debate on the quantitative assessments you provide. But model assumptions, of course, may be disputable. There are other behavior models than the ones these institutions use. Estimation methods can also justify a range of uncertainty. There's lack of information on relevant future variables. So how do you deal with this fact? And your policymakers, how do they respond to this fact of very fact of the economics profession that we cannot provide safe projections for the future? Now I give you the word, and Jenny, perhaps since you got most questions, you may start.
Okay, so just quickly moving through the questions. So in our legislation, major parliamentary parties is defined as parties that have five or more members before the election. So those are the parties that we have to provide a post-election report for. But minor parties can choose to opt in and have us provide a report for them. Thus far, we haven't had any minor parties have chosen to opt in, but this next election will be the test for that one. And in terms of the timing of our report, so our report isn't, I mean, unlike in the Netherlands, our post-election report is not actually released until 30 days after the election. So it's not released to the public before the election. But the consequence of parties knowing that we're going to release the report 30 days after the election has been that the parties themselves keep track, using the confidential costings we've given them, of what their election platform is costing, and they typically publish that platform and publish the cost of the platform before the election. And our post-election report, one of the key things is our statement in there as to whether our estimates accord with the numbers that the parties have published during the election campaign. So it's an ex post report, but it does seem to have quite a significant constraint on the behaviour of parties during election campaigns nonetheless. We have contemplated whether we could do a report before elections actually take place, and the trouble is that in Australia's context it would just have to really significantly change the dynamics of the election campaign to have party policies announced much earlier, which is what we would need. So that hasn't happened. Let me just quickly come to the question of ex post analysis. So an awful lot of the costings we do are for opposition parties, and so most of the costings that we've done have been for policies which haven't actually been implemented. So it's a long time after the costing that we actually can get some data to re-evaluate, you know, our performance. I guess the thing that we are doing is on a very regular basis is evaluating all of our individual costing models to get a sense as to whether the individual revenue profiles for the different components of revenue are evolving as we'd expect them to in the baseline. And that's just a kind of an ongoing process of testing the models. But ex post evaluation of specific costings, we've been able to do on a couple of occasions, but it's pretty challenging to do. Let me make a comment, Rhea, about your question in terms of uncertainty of point estimates. I mean, I think this is something that we all grapple with. I mean, but at the end of the day, we're dealing with budgets which have point estimate numbers in them. So while there is significant uncertainty around many of the estimates that we provide, I guess the onus upon us is to provide our best estimate of what the central, the most likely outcome would be. We deal with uncertainty really in three ways. We deal with it through a very clear statement about what the sources of uncertainty are. So in some cases the uncertainty is because the base data we're using for our costings is really poor, and there's nothing that can be done about that. Other times the uncertainty might be because of something that's happening in the economy at a particular point in time. You know, the housing cycle is very hard to predict, and therefore that's the source of uncertainty. So we try to be really transparent about the source of uncertainty as much as anything else, so that when we come back and re-cost policies, parliamentarians are not surprised if the costings of policies have changed significantly. So we do it through an uncertainty statement, which is quite significant, quite detailed. But the other thing that we do in situations where we think there is really a really wide range of uncertainty and there are quite plausible alternative assumptions that we can make for key elements of the costing, we will sometimes provide a central estimate, and then we'll provide a combination of scenarios and sort of sensitivity analysis to say, well, if it turned out that this particular assumption was different by this order of magnitude, this is the impact that you would expect it to have. So we sort of use all of those tools in order to provide a sense of the order of magnitude of uncertainty around central estimates. But I don't think that we can step away from providing central estimates in the world that we're working in.
Yeah, so let me briefly say something about the dynamic versus static scoring of tax measures. So the problem that you describe is very recognizable. I think that we have experienced that in the past as well. The way we manage it right now, because there's something that you cannot solve. There's no like a silver bullet that solves this problem. The way we have solved it now is that we try to manage it. So in the Netherlands, as I already said in my presentation, so basically all policies are set 4 years, they are fixed for a 4-year term, and they originate usually from the analysis of the election manifesto. So that's the opportunity for us to upfront manage this kind of, let's say, problems. So that's what we try to do. But in practice, you see that these kind of problems will arise. And as far as I remember, the last time that we had this kind of things, is that we just honestly said that we just don't know, so that we can do a dynamic scoring, and that we find something different, and we just. That is based on literature, but we don't know exactly if it's responsible to apply these elasticities for the Netherlands. And that's also a signal to policymakers and politicians that if we cannot reproduce it, there might be something wrong with this with their forecast. So that's the way that we managed it the last time. And if I remember correctly, that was also an outcome that, I mean, there wasn't a big problem anymore as far as I remember. But the problem that you're raising, that's a very recognizable one. We try to manage it up front. That's how we deal with it most of the times. So the question is on ex post and ex ante and uncertainty around the forecast. So I tried to answer them together. So I can tell you a bit about how we do it technically, but we also have a very practical solution for that. So uncertainty around the forecast and the difference between your ex ante and ex post assessment, and that can also evaluate over time, and how that works. In the policy debate, or in a political debate, could be difficult. So the way so what we are doing the past couple of years is that we invite all financial specialists from political parties, so including the members of parliament that are specialists in finance, and we explain them how our models work, how the budgetary cycle works, how all these forecasts works, how they work, and what you can learn from them and what you cannot learn from them. So we try to explain to them what the limitations of the models are. We try to explain to them that over time your insights could change, and that is sometimes driven by that you have new data or better data, and you want to incorporate those insights. And that's what we try to explain them, how that works. And we have what also helps is that we have very strong informal connections with the technical assistance of the political party. So they know who I am and I know who they are. So that makes the conversation a bit more easy. So what we just try to lecture those people and so that they understand what we're doing. And that's a solution to solve this problem. It's not perfect, but it's a solution. Thanks.
Thanks, Hui. George, you mentioned something interesting, which was, you know, you had to go out and look for comparable numbers or numbers that would give you ranges of possibilities for other countries because you didn't have that yourself. I think this is pretty much the spirit of what I described. That is, you have two options, basically, as a policymaker. You can go out there and do a survey of the literature. That can be casual or not. And there are different ways of doing this meta-analysis of the numbers that you get there. Or you can resort to some sort of more self-contained, stylized model that gives you ranges of impacts. We know the pros and cons of each one of them, but I think what is interesting in this type of situation is to be able to rely on at least some numbers that may be available for countries that you may consider as natural benchmarks to yours. Which brings me to my other comment, which is motivated by your question, Hui, which is, are we talking about uncertainty in the statistical sense? That is, we have a model and then we can statistically build ranges of confidence around estimates. I think that is one way of looking at that. And the other is to deal with model uncertainty more clearly, which is, are we missing some behavioral response that we're not going, that we are not, that we should be looking at? Those are also very different things, very important, but you need different tools to address them. Also looking at the nature and magnitudes of shocks that may be affecting the economy and then how that will affect the models that you may be parameterizing or calibrating based on numbers that are not the best ones to deal with that specific shock that you have. I think we are all making a lot of progress on that front. There is still a lot that can be done there, but I would distinguish those two types of uncertainty, which is the more statistical one about what are the parameters that the model provides you with, and the ones that have to do with more fundamental uncertainty about how the model is calibrated or how the model is designed itself. Thank you.
Welcome. Well, we may have time to collect two more questions, if there are. Well, otherwise, it seems that the clock is ticking in our stomach. And so I will close the session here, thanking our panelists for your very insightful addresses. I think the case studies you covered indeed showed us that there is much more than budgetary forecasting when we look or when IFAs and PBOs look at tax initiatives. And this has this fact has two consequences. On the one hand, of course, the budgetary impact, it's much more reliable when, before arriving at those figures, we are able to model the transmission mechanisms of the policy measure into or through the decisions of individual economic agents, and then we pull together their responses that translate into budget revenue. But this analytical work also gives evidence that there are other economic variables that are impacted and matter for citizens at large, like employment, like investment, not to mention microeconomic effects on competition and efficiency. And so I think bringing these elements to the political debate, policymakers end up with a much richer set of information when they finally have to vote on a specific tax reform. Okay, so much for this thematic session. Now I just want to make a couple of logistic points. Before moving to lunch, we have a short guided tour of the Parliament. This guided tour will start in this room, but some introductory words that will be provided kindly by the International Relations and Protocol Office of the Assembleia da República. And then we will split in two groups. One group will leave through that door and the other by that one. So perhaps we could already stand up and try let the market make it. Let's make a market test, see if automatically through Adam Smith's invisible hand we divide into two groups in this hemicycle. Okay, so then we will you will be led to the restaurant, and from then we will be taken back to a different room where the private section of our meeting will take place. Okay? So have a nice lunch. Thank you. Yes.